When she disappeared, it was during a tumultuous time in her family's life. Her sister isn't sure her parents even filed a missing persons report. But breakthroughs in genetic genealogy led authorities back to her sister, and also to a suspected serial killer. This is the story of Marion McWhorter, the missing Oregon woman whose body was identified almost 50 years later. Hi friends, I'm Katie, and this is Katie Does Crime. Thank you for joining me for the first time if you're new here. I'm a Midwesterner who now lives in New York City, putting my writing degree to use by researching true crime cases that interest me, and hopefully you. And hello to the usual rapscallions and reprobates. Please consider subscribing or joining me on Patreon if you'd like to hear more true crime stories. This case starts in a sort of romantic way. In July 1976, a 20-year-old man from Long Beach, California, was searching for moss to sell to florists in a remote area of Oregon called Sweet Home. But then, off of a logging trail, he came across some human remains, a skull and other small bones about a mile south of Highway 20. The police came back to look for more near Swamp Mountain Road and discovered a long bone, probably from a leg or an arm. Hair and decomposing clothing were found nearby. A fringed leather coat, a belt with a black and white beaded phoenix on it, a pair of Levi's, and a single clog. Authorities said the remains appeared to have been there for some time, maybe as long as 20 years, but they weren't sure. Later that month, investigators said the bones probably belonged to a young woman, white, 17 to 19, 5 foot five to 5 foot seven, about 120 pounds, with medium brown hair. No one fitting that description had been reported missing, though. The county sheriff said that today's younger generation moves around so much, she could be from any section of the country. They hoped her teeth could be matched with dental records, but they needed someone to come forward and identify her first. A medical examiner concluded that a wound track on her skull might have come from an ice pick or a small caliber gun, but that's about all they had. They named her Swamp Mountain Doe. What they didn't know is that her name was Marion Vanetta Nagel McWhorter, born January 7, 1953. She was the oldest of five and had been sort of a nomad before she disappeared. The 21-year-old last called her aunt from a payphone in October 1974 in Tigard, south of Portland, at the Washington Square Mall. She had hitchhiked from California to Oregon and was planning to go to Seattle next and then Alaska. She hoped her aunt would pick her up in Tigard and let her spend the night, but her aunt said she was too busy to come get her, and Marion said that was okay. A man in a white pickup had offered to drive her. No one ever heard from her after that. Marion's sister, now in her 60s, says her parents didn't really talk much about Marion after she vanished, and she's not even sure a missing persons report was filed, which would align with the police saying that they didn't know of a missing person who fit the description of the remains the moss hunter found. Those bones and clothing were found about 100 miles away from that payphone where Marion told her aunt a man was going to give her a ride. Luckily, years later, the Oregon State Medical Examiner's Office got a grant that would allow them to do DNA testing on people they hadn't been able to identify. They tested the remains of Swamp Mountain Doe and were able to determine a little bit about her genetic makeup. She was European and Native American and had fair skin, brown eyes, and brown hair. But that's all they knew. They made a forensic rendering of her face, and they waited. And then one day in early 2025, a cousin's profile was suddenly uploaded to a genetic database. Genealogists saw the connection, created a family tree, and found that their Swamp Mountain Doe had a sister. They contacted the woman, and she did a DNA swab. They confirmed that their unidentified woman with the fringe leather jacket was Marion McWhorter. The sister told the authorities that they had a difficult childhood. Their oldest brother had died in March 1974, and it was a traumatic time for the family. Marion was separated from the rest of the kids when their parents took the younger siblings and moved from California to New York. Their mother was an indigenous Alaskan, and Marion was named after an aunt who died in an American Indian boarding school in Alaska. Marion had two kids, one of which she gave up for adoption because she was only 16, and one she left behind with her ex-husband. Marion's sister believed that she was headed toward Alaska to find work because their grandfather lived there. and because she was trying to get out of an abusive relationship. The police noted that Marion's nose had been broken previously. Her sister was only 11 when Marion disappeared, and she had never stopped looking. She hopes to properly lay her sister to rest after almost 50 years. An Oregon forensic anthropologist said this was one of the oldest unidentified cases in the state. Now, I love when advances in DNA help identify a missing person like this, but this case is even more interesting because of its potential ties to a serial killer. There's a chance that Marion was a victim of the Highway 20 killer, John Arthur Aykroyd, who attacked women from the late 1970s to the early 1990s along US 20. In the 70s, when Marion went missing, John Aykroyd was a 20-something state highway mechanic with a route along 20. He would help people whose cars had broken down or move wrecks off the road when they happened. He was raised in Sweet Home and had all of the trappings of a normal life. A good family with two sisters, a wife, a couple of stepkids, an interest in hunting and fishing, and a good job. But he had also been a poor student and a loner who was bullied. When he was facing felony theft charges as a teenager, he enlisted in the Army to get out of them and served from 1968 to 1976. Although any leave he took wasn't recorded, Oregon Live found that he was ticketed for driving violations in 1970 and 1972 in Sweet Home. He was also cited nearby in 1976 for carrying a pistol. So he definitely could have been home in Oregon in 1974 when Marion went missing and was just, you know, not catching the eye of the police with his bad driving or gunslinging for once. A friend said Aykroyd cut up puppies with a machete and hacked the tails off of squirrels just for fun, and he would stop and rewind the parts of horror movies where women got chopped up. He would do this even when he invited the neighbors over to watch the movies with him. But when he left the Army and got his state highway job, he was reliable enough. Of course, his position meant he spent a lot of time alone in his truck along Highway 20, and that he knew all of the back roads and paths into the woods. His first alleged victim was Marlene Gabrielson, a 20-year-old mother who hitched a ride with him in 1977. She and her husband had been at the rodeo in Sisters, Oregon, when they had an argument. She left to look for a ride and unfortunately ran into Aykroyd in his truck. He pulled her into the woods off Highway 20 at knife point, cut off her boots, ripped off her jeans, and assaulted her. When he was done, she begged him to let her live and take her home to her baby. He gave her a pair of plaid pants from the back of his truck because hers were in tatters from how forcefully he pulled them off of her. He stopped to see his mom and grab a soda as he drove Marlene home. She was so smart, asking for his phone number as if she was going to try to see him again. But when she reported him to the police, he told them she had been the aggressor. As if to back him up, his mom said he was shy around women. Marlene and Aykroyd both took polygraph tests, and she was determined to be the liar. So no charges were ever filed, and Aykroyd was free to find more victims. Two teens went missing 3 years after Marion, 15-year-old Karen Lee and 14-year-old Rodney Grissom, and like her, their last known whereabouts were at a payphone. Their bodies were never found, but their clothes were. Off Highway 20, also in the woods, Aykroyd's calling card. He's also suspected of killing two more teenagers, 17-year-old Melissa Sanders and 19-year-old Sheila Swanson, in Newport in 1992. The last time they were heard from, they were on a camping trip, and like the girls before them, they also made a call from a payphone saying they were going to hitchhike for a ride. They liked to hang out at a coffee shop in Oregon, where they were known to chat with Aykroyd. After they disappeared in the spring, Aykroyd showed up to work covered in blood, but he said he'd hit a deer and had to butcher it on the road. His co-workers only thought something of it when hunters found the bodies of Melissa and Sheila in the woods that fall. Bones from another woman, only known as Snow Creek Doe, were found near Highway 20 in the late 70s by loggers. Her skull had a hole in it, just as Marion's skull had been marked by a wound. But apparently the medical examiner threw away the bones years ago, saying that police would never be able to solve the case on so little. Aykroyd's also suspected of killing his 13-year-old stepdaughter, Rashonda Pickle, who was last seen at home in the summer of 1990 before she disappeared forever. She lived there with her mom and Aykroyd. He was an angry man, quick to give his stepdaughter a black eye or tear out some of her hair when he decided something was her fault. He and Rashonda's mom had actually only been married for a year in the 80s before they divorced, but they still lived together. I guess the woman wanted help raising her kids. Rashonda never wanted to go home after school, and friends knew it was because her stepdad was doing things to her that he shouldn't be. On July 10th, Rashonda's mom went off to work at her job as a housekeeper, and Aykroyd left too, but then he returned. And the little girl was never heard from again. Apparently, Aykroyd had such a low libido that even his stepson knew about it, which I take to mean that his mom must have complained. But that night, Aykroyd wanted to be intimate with Rashonda's mom, and the police think the murder must have excited him. They were also skeeved out that he knew the teenager's bra size and talked at length in interviews about her development, but he couldn't remember when her birthday was.
When little girls run away in family, sometimes there's a reason for this, and I ask you if you ever sexually abused your daughter, right? And your answer was no. And I'm not accusing you of sexual abuse, and we're just conducting an investigation. We want to make sure that every angle is covered.
My sexual activity, like a bad high of sex, you know, and maybe not getting that number. And I'm trying to get the balance, you know, maybe, I have a bit of fresh stuff here, you know. That's sick, you know. But I know there's people out there who do that all the time. And I know some of them.
So many of these disappearances are assumed to be Aykroyd's doing, but he was actually convicted at trial for one. Kay Turner went for a run while on vacation at Camp Sherman off Highway 20 on Christmas Eve 1978 and never returned. Another highway worker said he saw her out running and that he also saw Aykroyd driving through the area, so the police questioned Aykroyd. He said he did see the woman but was on his way to hunt coyotes, and the police bought his story. Kay's husband seemed the more likely perp, or maybe one of the two men she'd been recently sleeping with. Her footprints were discovered in the woods at the time, but not her body. In August of the following year, Aykroyd told the police that he'd found some of Kay's things while hunting rabbits. I have no idea why he'd do this, other than that maybe he was getting bold. Or maybe he thought they wouldn't suspect he was the killer if he was so willing to hand over her remains. He led them to Kay's clothes and watch, and they were able to uncover her skull there. Everything seemed so suspicious to the police, especially when they kept questioning Aykroyd and his story kept changing. Now he had actually stopped and talked to Kay when he saw her out running. Then he had actually seen her body in the woods 2 months after she disappeared and didn't report it. But another man, a convicted murderer, confessed to the crime, so police stopped looking at Aykroyd. They would find out later, much later, that this confession was false. It was only after Aykroyd's stepdaughter disappeared in 1990 that the police circled back on him and his alibi for that morning on Christmas Eve when Kay was killed. Aykroyd said he'd been at a friend's house, and when police originally interviewed that friend's wife, she backed up his claims. But now she was saying she lied like hell back then. That Aykroyd and the friend went out hunting and came back with their clothes so bloody she had to throw them out. At first, they told her that they accidentally shot Kay when they thought she was a deer. Then they changed their story and said that they assaulted her before they shot her, and that they'd do the same to this woman if she didn't lie for them. It took 15 years of detective work, but Aykroyd finally went to trial for Kay's murder in 1993. There was no physical evidence tying him to the crime, but the witnesses against him were compelling, especially another young woman who said Aykroyd once stopped her at gunpoint while she was biking at Camp Sherman. That was, of course, the same place where Kay disappeared. She was lucky that she had the guts to just keep riding. The jury convicted Aykroyd in only 4 hours, along with his friend who'd shown up at home with the bloody clothes and made his wife lie. They were both given life sentences. And then, in 2013, Aykroyd agreed to plead no contest in Rashonda's murder. He did admit to killing her, but he knew he didn't have much of a chance at trial now that he was a convicted murderer. As part of the deal, he said he would never put himself up for parole. And true to his word, he died in prison in December 2016 from heart disease. Detectives had still been working behind the scenes, and he would have faced charges for the deaths of Melissa and Sheila had he stayed alive any longer. It feels a little anticlimactic, this guy only sorta kinda taking the blame and then dying without telling anyone where the bodies are buried. But at least he won't hurt anyone else. It's hard to know how many other victims Aykroyd may have had, and it haunts investigators to think about how long he got away with the crimes he definitely committed. The state police captain says they're aware of Marion's case and are working to find out more about how she died, and if Aykroyd may have been her killer. Thank you to Oregon Live for all of their incredible reporting. Thank you for tuning into my podcast episode. I'm just a true crime fan like you are, and I really appreciate you taking a chance on me. Please subscribe and tell a friend if you like spending this time together. You can also find me on YouTube in the flesh by searching Katie Does Crime.